Listen to my words as they vanish. Let's go chase the sun. Hello and welcome to the Dad Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Worsham. With us today is our very good friend, Dr. Jay Suter, stand-up pediatrician.
Hey there, Justin. How are you, buddy? Good to talk to you.
The pleasure is mine, good sir. The pleasure is mine. I didn't talk to you. We were chatting. People were listening to us live. I don't know if they even heard this part. Do you want to talk about real quick your head trauma? You are wrapped up like a 1930s movie person who's been hit in the head with an anvil.
Yeah, it looked like I was Marley's ghost there with the head wrapping around my head there. I was in the Bahamas for a week, which was my vacation. And while I was down there, I had the good opportunity to be able to work at the Joker's Wild Comedy Club down at Atlantis. And it was wonderful. I got to work with four great comedians, Dave Landau, Matt McClowery, Paul Hooper, I worked with, and
I love
Derek
Dave
Kennedy.
Landau. I don't know the other guys. Dave Landau is one of the nicest guys in the world. And if anybody sees him, his name is spelled Landau is his last name. Very right. Funny guy.
Yeah, just one night I got to work with them the first night, and then they switched the comics over to Paul and Derek, and it was great. I had a blast, and then the last night that I was there was down in the casino. It also happened to be the night the Yanks were eliminated from the ALCS, which was sad. And I'm not quite exactly sure how it happened, but I stood up at a slot machine, and then I tripped, and I smacked my head on the corner of another slot machine, ended up with 2.5-inch laceration on the back of my head. It was funny because I went to security and the guy said, well, let's take a look at it. And he said, oh, that's going to need some stitches. And then they called the EMT and said a lot of times the EMTs will do the stitches right there in the ambulance in the parking lot. So I was hopeful that would happen because I didn't want to have to go to the emergency room. But the EMT came, and as soon as she looked at it, the first words out of her mouth was, whoa. I said, you know, I'm a doctor. That's not really good bedside manner when you're looking at someone's open head wound, by the way. Just thought I'd give you a little critique there. So they ended up taking me to the ER, and I got 14 stitches in the back of my head. So I'm finally done there at like 6:15 in the morning. I got to leave for the airport at 10.
Oh.
And they call to get a cab for me, and there are no cabs in service at that time of the morning. So – I said, all right, well, if it's only a 15-minute walk, I'll walk back with my head wound. And they said, no, we won't let you walk back. I said, why? Are you worried about my head? He goes, no, it's the neighborhood. They'll kill you. I said, oh, okay, then I'll wait until the cabs are available. And then the security guy, because he knew I had to go get a plane at 10, said, I'll just drive you. So someone sat for him at the desk, and the security guard drove me back to Atlantis in his car.
Wow. And this is all in the Bahamas, so these people are the best, the salt of the earth.
Yeah, I mean, I was, I'm Sute party of one. I decided, you know, if I don't have a significant person to go on these little vacations with, I'm not going to miss out on going away. But my daughters have now put the kibosh on that. Apparently, I'm not allowed to travel alone anymore.
Somebody in the chat room wants to know if you were concussed at all.
I wasn't knocked out. No, I had maintained consciousness the whole time. In fact, I think the wonderful Dr. Eugene Smith that sewed my head back together had a little bit of difficulty because I was going through most of my act with him while he was trying to suture me, and his hands were moving a lot because of his giggling and laughter.
Well, so. That's good. How many shows have you done for other doctors?
Oh, other doctors? I've done a bunch of them.
That's a common thing?
Yeah. Connecticut, Medical Associates. I've done a bunch of yearly meetings and stuff in Connecticut. I wish I could do more, in fact. But, between that and pharmaceuticals, I think that's where eventually I would be able to make some money with my pediatric nonsense.
Oh, yeah. No kidding. I think we've talked about this before, but for a while I was hosting a thing for Bayer. They had if I'm not mistaken, a colon cancer medication, and I would go to conventions for nurses and where they would kind of give nurses the update, and I would host a game show. So they would have these nurses and doctors give research data on the medication, and then to challenge the nurses that were there at the luncheon, you would play this, you know, game where they would have to answer multiple choice questions to kind of keep it fun and lively while it was happening.
Yeah, that's great.
And boy, howdy, was that a nice paycheck. Holy crap.
I can only imagine how nice that's got to be, because it is, that's where the money is.
If memory serves, it was at least $5,000 or $6,000 just for a day. I'm like, are you kidding me?
If there are so many drug companies that want doctors to go out and just read off of slides and give a presentation, and they pay you lots and lots of money. All I want to do is my comedy act. I don't want to do slides. It's crazy.
That's funny. All right. Well, let's go. Well, I'm glad you're okay. I'm glad you're back stateside. I'm sorry about the Yanks. I know there was a lot of talk here in Dodger Town that it would be fun to have a New York LA World Series. Everybody was kind of bummed. But also, I don't know. I don't follow baseball, so maybe this isn't a good path for me to walk down with you. But that there was also hope that it would be the Yankees, because there was a belief that the Dodgers would walk all over the Yankees. I'm sure you, as a passionate Yankee fan, would disagree with that. But
I just think this Yankee team that we had this year was such a likable team. It was the most fun baseball season I can remember since the late 90s. Just even though we didn't win, what a fun team we had to watch all year. I mean, that it was a really fun time. A nice ride. Didn't end the way, you know, they did better than they were expected to do. And then, you know, kind of get caught up in it. And this, you know, they're kids. Next year is going to be our year.
How many games, because part of the, I wonder about the baseball season, it's like 180 something games or something. I feel like there is
162 during the regular season, but then you also have spring training and postseason. So
now, are you passionate enough Yankee? Are you a passionate enough Yankee fan that you watch all of these?
Yes, pretty much.
And how many do you go to the stadium to see?
This year I went to one game at the stadium against the Reds, and then on Labor Day I went to see the Yanks play the Orioles down at Camden Yards, because I was in the Baltimore Comedy Festival, and it just worked out that that I was able to go see the Yanks, that they were on the down in Baltimore on the day I was down there. It just worked out beautifully.
And then I guess the Dodgers already, well, I don't, spoilers, but that's not a spoiler. Dodgers already won game one last night.
Yes.
So things are looking good for the boys in blue, as they call them here.
You know, and I think you got the two best teams playing. So it's a good World Series. I think it'll be great. The Astros, I mean, I was amazed. I mean, that shortstop they have, the little 5'6" guy batted like 340 something this year. Unbelievable. Jose Altuve. What a talented player. So. But you know what? You guys got your Dodgers out there, so you're all, you know, into the Dodger thing, and we're all done for the year. So that's the sad part of baseball, you know.
All right. Well, then let's get into the stuff that we have to talk about here. I want to start with the question that we got from Facebook. It comes from Jessica from our Hot Moms Club. She wants to know about teen acne. Easiest ways to help them care for their skin. Then parenthetical, she's a semi-lazy, maybe he just doesn't care all that much, maybe his mom is a nag, maybe he doesn't have a reason to care yet. I'm assuming that means girls, but more, I'm looking for physical things he could do to help. Not interested in this time in pharma approach.
Well, here's the deal. I always try to start with the kids early, around like 12, to get them into the habit of washing their face twice a day with soap and water, because if you can get the dirt, the oil, and the grime off their face, that's half the battle. And if you can start it at 12, by the time they really need to be doing it at 14 and 15, it's just part of their regular routine. So that most young kids under 14, can get by just using a simple soap and water twice a day. I tell them once in the shower and once at the sink to use, you know, don't just throw water on your face. Use soap and wash your face with soap and water twice a day. That usually takes care of things. And then if they wanted to use something over the counter, like a, you know, 10% benzoyl peroxide, like Clearasil or Oxy-10 or something like that to kill the surface bacteria, they don't need to do more than that until 14 or 15. And then at 14 or 15, you know, probably half of the kids get by just using soap and water, and half of the kids keep doing it the way they were doing it and it was working well. But, you know, biology makes it a little harder to manage with just hygiene, and you sometimes need to start them on a topical that helps to unclog the pores. So, you know, there's three things to treat acne. There's topical antibiotics like benzoclin, benzamycin, cleocin. That just treats and kills the surface bacteria. Then you have the retinoids like Tazorac and Retin-A and Adaptalene. Those help to unclog the pores. They break down the keratin and the stuff that kind of clogs up your pores and opens it up so that the skin can breathe. So the combination of a topical antibiotic and a topical retinoid to open up the pores is usually a good plan, and that gets most kids through their adolescence. Occasionally, you got to start them on an oral antibiotic like doxycycline, which will treat them from the inside out for bacteria. Also protects them from Lyme disease while they're taking the doxycycline. And
for any of the pirate? No, Lyme disease is from a tick. Right. I was thinking of scurvy.
Right. You're thinking of scurvy. No. Just drink your orange juice for that.
Oh, okay.
And then the last resort is Retin-A. Accutane, which is an oral medicine that helps to unclog the pores, but it's just for with a lot of side effects, so you have to have a very limited group of kids that really, really, really need Accutane. If you used it on everyone, there would be too many side effects and they'd take it off the market. So topical antibiotics, then topical antibiotics plus something to break down the stuff that clogs the pores. Sometimes add an oral antibiotic, and then last and final approach is Accutane.
Now,
but I think a good hygiene schedule, if parents show kids pictures, images of horrible acne scarred kids,
there it is,
on their Google, I think that is a good way of getting them to start washing their face twice a day with soap and water at the age of 12. Girls might have to start a little earlier because their puberty growth spurt starts 9 or 10. Boys are more like 11, 12. So it wouldn't be unusual for a little girl to start having a little bit of trouble with acne at even 10 or 11.
And I think emphasis on the scars part, in case anybody missed that, is that the aftermath of you can't just show them acne, but if you show them Edward James Olmos and his face, then, you know,
good example, either that or Manuel Noriega.
Oh, good call.
They look like they were victims of smallpox, but that's acne's.
Don't you wish you had a picture of an acne riddled Edward James Olmos, too, just to kind of be like, this is what happened and this is the aftermath? Like,
no. Videotapes of him picking them and popping them.
Is that really what causes the scars like that?
Well, what happens is when you pop a pimple, it seems like that same pimple seems to come back for like the next month, but it's not that same pimple. When you pop that pimple, you destroy the pore structure of all the pores around that pimple. So every one of those pores is going to become a new pimple for you.
Wow. So you're not supposed to pop them at all?
No.
Oh, no.
I think we may have talked about this once before, but somebody spread rumors about putting toothpaste on a pimple to dry it up and make it go away. And the old days, toothpaste was just toothpaste, but now it has peroxides and bleaching and all this other stuff, and it will leave a burn on your face bigger than the pimple.
Somebody's in the chat room. My wife always says goldfish crackers are bad for eight-year-olds. Oh, that's another question. Sorry. I thought he was talking about the acne thing. So here's my question, is that I feel like I used to see a bunch of advertisements, and I don't know if it's because now I'm, you know, 38, and so therefore I'm not worried about acne anymore, but what happened to all of those, you know, the pads and the, you know, that you would wipe clean? Is it because Proactiv had just eliminated all of them, do you think, or do you even know?
And Proactiv is nothing more than benzoyl peroxide. I mean, there's no prescription medicine in Proactiv. What Proactiv does is it gives you a recipe to follow, and if you follow the recipe, you're going to have clearer skin. And if you use the antiseptics, which are nothing more than Oxy-10-like products that the Proactiv people have, if you follow their recipe and their regimen, it's going to get better. Just like if you wash your face twice a day with soap and water, it's going to get better.
Is witch hazel a more like homeopathic way to approach it or no?
It's just a drying agent, much like the topical, I'm trying to think of what the name of the product is, but they have topical ASA, salicylic acid, like aspirin as a drying agent and solution for acne. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that they use, Clean and Clear, I think, or something like that is what does that. And it's just a drying agent to dry up the grease and the oil.
So to sum it up, you're saying show them, if you can't motivate them to start by washing the face once in the morning and once at night before they go to bed, is that a, or is, right. should they do yep. it after school, yep. or the more the merrier?
The more the better, but no scrubbing, because if you scrub and you rub and you abrade, you destroy pore structure, and that makes more pimples. So,
you don't want an exfoliation type situation. You don't want a loofah sponge to the face. You just want hands with some soap on it to get the oil off.
That's it.
And if they're if they're at school and say they're doing a PE thing, is it is just a simple rinse with some water to wipe off the sweat? Yep. Is that enough?
They also have, I think Neutrogena makes those, I think they call them grease absorbers or oil absorbing wipes and stuff. So they have those too for when you need to just do a quick touch up.
But if your kid's washing their face 2 to 3 times a day and yep. is with still soap. Just is, you know, borderline Quasimodo with the pimple in the face, then that's when you reach out to a pediatrician or a general practitioner to look for the antibiotics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The retinols you were talking about.
And don't go to a dermatologist will be able to take care of it well. But I mean, acne is something that most pediatricians can deal with until they get to the point where a kid is a candidate for Accutane. So I treat most of, you know, my teenagers with acne myself, but if they're not responding, I always will then refer them for, you know, a consultation with the dermatologist. But, you know, it'll take, in my area, I don't know what it's like in California, but it takes at least 6 weeks to get an appointment with a dermatologist.
Yeah.
So most people call when they have a rash, and by the time the appointment comes, the rash is gone. So, no reason to get started on something for acne with a dermatologist. Just talk to your regular pediatrician, and they certainly can see you quicker and get you going in the right direction a lot quicker than waiting 6 more weeks. So.
Is washing the pillowcases more often a thing? Does that actually help or not really?
Well, I think just regular, general washing is fine. I mean, they're going to one thing to mention, though, if they are going to put any benzoyl peroxide products on, that does bleach.
Yes.
So having a white pillowcase to go to sleep at night, if that's when you put your topicals on, is important because it'll bleach clothing. It'll bleach linens and things like that as well.
I want to say it was maybe during her pregnancy or maybe it was just after something. My wife had an issue with acne, and so she started doing the Proactiv. And then, but she bleached all of her towels when she would wipe her face dry.
right.
We didn't know. And of course we're broke and we were like, oh crap. Well, now we got this nice blue towel with a gigantic red spot the size of her face. The only way it would have been funnier if the eye sockets were in it. So at least you could tell it was her face, but it was just a blob of whiteness. let's do one quick question, then we'll take a break and get into the other stuff because I am curious about this. I like is the phrasing of this question. So I'm not going to use your name in case your wife also listens to the podcast, and you're just going to have to rely on your fellow friends in the chat room to protect your anonymity. But he says, my wife always says goldfish crackers are bad for our 8-year-old. True? I like how he's throwing his wife under the bus.
Well, if the child is living on goldfish crackers, that probably is not enough, because I have known children to live on chocolate Dunkin' Munchkins. So I'm not surprised if that could be a complete 100% well-balanced diet for an 8-year-old. But no, I mean, anything in moderation is fine. We have to watch the carbs. That's the biggest thing, though. And now everything I've ever learned in medicine is topsy-turvy now. You say stay away from fats. Now it's stay away from carbs.
Yeah.
So the thing is, if things are balanced, you're probably okay. When did people start getting fat? When we switched whole milk into 1%, 2% yeah. in fat free. Whole milk, the way God made it, was a well-balanced fluid for our body to ingest. But when you take out the fats and leave all the sugars, not a good thing. So I tend to think everything in moderation is fine. And, you know, if you have an 8-year-old that is addicted to goldfish crackers, there are worse things, I suppose.
See, and here's
could be addicted to ring-dings like I was.
There's a thing where I'm going to see this nutritionist, and I've lost about, now I think I'm up to almost 27, 28 pounds that I've lost in almost 2 months.
And, good for you.
And I feel amazing. I'm feeling great. I know that you and I have talked about it where, and you said, just for full disclosure, the lady that started me down this path, although she referred me to A nutritionist who has a PhD in nutrition. I think, I don't know what it is, maybe nutrition-based medicine. Or anyway, so she's a nutritionist. That's her gig. And what really has helped me is I've heard the same thing. I've heard it go back and forth multiple times as I've been trying to lose weight. And the thing that really nailed it down for me is that she basically has put it to where she says, you want 75% of your plate to be vegetables, 25% of it to be protein, and cut out almost entirely all the carbs. And she was recently, now I can have like these, they found a sensitivity I have to wheat and gluten and all this stuff.
Well, because that's because you live in California.
That's true. People, yes. It's contagious.
All you pussies have a gluten problem.
That's so true. Trust
me. Tell me anyone ever predicted human beings would have difficulty digesting bread.
Definitely not the Egyptians. I can tell you that.
Holy Christ.
But it's so funny because, well, and here's what it is. I don't think it's like, I thought it had to do with the grains and this, the lady who started this clinic, she gets to where she talks about how a lot of the gluten we eat is radioactive, and it's hard for me to swallow it, and I know I'm entirely ignorant, so I'm not disagreeing with her because this lady is really helping a lot of people. But here, let me put it to you. The thing I think is what happened to me is where I'm going way off topic. Sorry, I'll make this quick. But the way she explained it to me is that when I was overweight, I was very inflamed. It wasn't a lot of excessive body fat, but it was mostly inflammation, or a big chunk of it was inflammation. Mm-hmm. And so she says the cells in your intestines are packed really, really tight. But when you get inflammation, especially in your gut, the cells separate. And that little gap allows food particles to get through and into your bloodstream. And so there would be like the tiniest particle of, say, an almond or a piece of gluten or wheat flour or eggs. What is
a pinoli nut.
You're going to guess. These are all things on my food. She says, usually when we do this food sensitivity test, which basically what this measures, my understanding is that these are food items that in my bloodstream they found antibodies for. So right. that it means that these pieces of food got into my bloodstream and my immune system says that's not supposed to be here and sees it as a virus and makes antibodies for it so that anytime it finds it in my body, it immediately attacks it. So it was almonds, Brazil nuts, cashews, dairy, any kind of cow's milk.
So you weren't having an anaphylactic reaction to it, but your body was reacting to it with an inflammatory reaction.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And so what they've told me is that I need to stay away from these things. Coconut was another one. Avocados, which I hardly ever ate until I got on this diet, at least as far as I can
tell. So far, I'm not suffering. I don't eat a single thing you just mentioned. Carrots. None of those things I eat. I hate all of them.
Carrots was another one. So anyway, so I have to stay away from these things for a year, and then they'll do this test again, and then hopefully
the numbers came down.
Yes.
And then, actually reintroduce them and see if anything changes.
Yeah. So her thing is that what'll happen is after a year, most, if not all, of these items on this list will fall off because the antibodies will just kind of go away because they're not being used. Does that sound
right?
Sound to you?
Okay, yeah. Great. But sometimes as soon as you're exposed to it again, the antibody levels go up again. So, that's what they're testing for.
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's interesting because I had chronic hives for 18 months, and basically that was my body inflamed. All of the inflammatory markers in my blood tests were like off the charts, and it was I was allergic to something, and then it took 18 months, and they just went away. I saw allergists, people, immunologists to figure out what the hell was causing it. They never figured it out, except I was getting hives every day and all of my inflammatory markers were up. So it was when I was probably at my fattest. I mean, believe it or not, I was as big as 265 at one time. And that was a big, fat, big ball of goo that looked like he was going to eat the children and not really take care of them. So,
put that baby in my belly.
Well, so what I learned from them is that I can have tiger nut flour, which is, I think, a tubule or something like that. It's like a root that they make flour out of. And what she likes about it is that it is low in carbs, high in fat. And that is the basis of my new diet. And so the reason I fell down and into that hole is because what I wanted to ask you is that, let's say we have a kid who's really ingesting a lot of carbohydrates. Can you or do you feel comfortable breaking it down in like a percentage? What's a good percentage of the day throughout the day of your intake or your kid's intake, I should say, to be carbohydrates?
Well, I think kids are different because they're constantly on the go too, and they don't have the you know, the stomach capacity to be able to eat humongous meals. So it's usually a lot of small meals. So the younger kids might only eat one good meal a day and pick at the other, you know, too. So you got to hit them. If you know their best meal is lunch, well, then that's the one that you want to hit them with as much of the good stuff as you can. And if they're only picking at the other meals, that might be the meals where you get the little bit of carbs. But I kind of agree. I think you said 75-25, very little carbs. I think kids need carbs because they need short acting energy because they don't have the, you know, the energy stores that adults do. So, you know, they go through it very fast. With adults who eat carbs and don't burn it off, the carbs turn into fat. But for kids, you know, they're usually pretty active, and they burn up the carbs so that they aren't excessive carbs so that they don't turn to fat. But, you know, like I said, do I fat shame 3-year-olds? Yeah, I do. It's part of my job description now. So
it's expected. It's the word. Thanks, Obama.
Yeah, I know. And now, Tony, I mean, I have no idea. The bottom line with all this healthcare crap is they haven't figured out how to pay doctors yet. That's what it is. Not a healthcare crisis. It's a how do we pay doctors crisis. That's what it is.
Well, you're making too much money, Doc. That's the real problem. Don't you know
that's
that?
That's the problem. Oh, yeah. We're sucking the system dry. And you're getting $60,000 a month to get treated for hepatitis C. And the doctor who's running the IV for the $60,000 medicine gets about $50.
All right. Well, then on that note, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back before we get, because she's got a head wound. We don't want to increase your blood pressure and just slip you into some kind of stroke situation.
Yeah, these headphones are starting to hurt. So.
We'll be right back after this. Hey, if you want to find some like-minded parents and some just all around good, solid internet friends, and hell, you might even find somebody here that lives in your area. I highly recommend that you go to the Staying Frosty with the Dad podcast fan page. It's run by our very own Butcher Drew.
All right, all right, all right.
And he gets all of the parents together there, and we've got some common people. Dr. J himself will pop by there and make a comment or two or let you know when we're recording because he's awesome. Rachel Wright. I did that on the titling of the episode at the beginning, and she's married now. I got to remember it. Rachel Wright from WrightWellnessCenter.com, our sex and family therapist. She'll also jump in there. She shares some of the stuff she's got going on at Right Wellness Center. It's not only a fun place that you can share memes or have fun conversations, but just a great way to interact and share your, you know, parental fails without feeling like you're being judged, or tell a story about how you told your kid to fuck off and everybody will laugh as opposed to, like, you know, looking at you side-eyed like you're a crazy abusive parent who deserves to be reported to the Child Protective Services people. All right. So again, Staying Frosty with the Dad podcast on Facebook. Just find it and ask to join the group, and Butcher Drew will get you right on there right fast. You don't want it. So it's that time of season. I think I'm late. This is the latest I've been. The whole genesis of Dr. J being on this show was I was in Connecticut playing at the Hartford Funny Bone, and he was our fantastic house MC. I was there with our friend Heath Heitch, who was just on the show, just had a daughter.
I listened to that episode. Yeah, that was great.
And so it's funny because I think I mentioned, and I can't remember how he said it, but what I remember was when I said, oh, you could have Dr. J. He goes, wait, Dr. J? Like, our Dr. J? I was like, yeah. And so we were going to Alabama next, and there was a huge flu epidemic in Alabama. And so Dr. J said he could hook us up with some flu shots. And it was through his edification that I learned I need to start getting regular. So now I have an annual calendar alert in my phone at the first day of September to say, get the flu shot appointments. but I have not actually done the flu shot. But so now,
so immediately, that's really working well. Your system's
how
working.
Dare you? This is 1 year in a very long time that we have now known each other. So go fuck yourself. Yeah.
I got mine 2 weeks ago. The nurse that's given me my flu shot for the last 25 years retired last November. So I made her make a guest appearance because there's no need for anyone else to see my fleshy upper arm. So she came in and gave it to me this year. I took her out of retirement for a shot.
Oh, nice. So I'm going to, as soon as I'm done with this episode, I'm going to set our appointment. My kids have now gotten excited about it because they like the idea that now they don't get scared of shots and they're tough. And so that's an accomplishment for them, which I also like. Yeah. It's a good thing. But what you sent me was that the CDC panel again advises against the flu mist. Now, what this is that's the nasal spray, correct?
Yes. Yes, sir. The one all the kids like.
And this is, am I right? Is this the second flu season or year in a row that they're saying the flu mist does not work?
Yes, that is exactly it. They decided that there wasn't enough to prove that the kinks that prevented it from boosting the immunity a couple years ago weren't worked out enough. And it's sad because they made it all. They just
it's like building out a neighborhood because you think the city is booming and then all of a sudden, nope, there's a bust. And then now there's just empty houses sitting there that all this money has been dumped into. Right.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, it's too bad because it, you know, was appealing to most of the kids. And, you know, when they find out that the, you know, they can't get the nose spray and they've got to get the shot. Well, there is a look of terror on their face. So, you know, what are you going to do? We do it this way. It's like pulling off a Band-Aid. Tuesdays and Thursdays at the end of the day, usually we see patients from 8:30 to 5. And at 5:15 to 6:30, we have about 70, 80 kids come in after hours. And we just, like an assembly line, we just stick around and give 70, 80 shots twice a week after hours. And that's how you get 3,000 kids done between September and the end of December.
Wow, that's amazing. 3,000 kids.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
It's free. You know, and again, I say 3,000 because I know we don't get to everybody, but I have almost 5,000 kids on my panel. So, you know, some of the kids will get them at college and stuff so that, you know, they may get them, but I may not be the one giving them. You know, other. I think actually your timing is right. And if I'm not mistaken, the first time I gave you the flu vaccine was in November.
Yeah,
I think if you get it by mid-November, you're in good shape. The last couple years, the flu's hit in the late in the season, like last week of February. March was probably the worst month of the year last year in the United States for flu. So we have time to get it in, and you just want to make sure that you've got coverage through April. So you know, October, November is probably the perfect time to get it. You know, September might be a little early, but for 3,000 shots to get given in 3 months, I got to start at some point. So we try to do the young ones. The kids who have never gotten a flu vaccine before have to get two vaccines the first year that they get it. So that in September, we do a lot of the 6 and 9 month olds that didn't get last year's flu vaccine. And then when they come back in October, November, they get that booster dose and that protects them for the season. So it's just a lot of extra work. And let me tell you, without any kind of big financial payoff and for people who think doctors make a lot of money, let me tell you, working from 8:30 to 5 and then having an hour and a half of screaming kids to end your day. Listen, there ain't enough money in the world to pay me for that. So might as well pay me nothing.
Your extra income really just goes to cover whatever scotch intake that you need just to get through the stress of it.
Yeah, and the overtime for the nurses and the secretaries that have
right, because if you have your own practice,
people in and out of the office in an hour and a half. So you know, it's just and that it's a non money making situation. It's it's primary care, it's preventive care, it's a lot of phone calls and scheduling and sending out emails and cards, and there's a lot of work that goes into it with very little payoff. So
it says here that the Food and Drug Administration is still approving the flu mist for ages 2 to 49, but the CDC is saying it's not effective enough to be suggested. So they're saying, you know, it's probably not good. And what they're saying is that, and I think this is in the 2015-16 study that the quadrivalent vaccine, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the quadrivalent has two A strains and two B strains of a weakened version of the. So they have, like, say, hundreds of strains of the flu virus is what my understanding is from this article.
And that has four in it.
Yeah, and they pick the four that they think will be the most effective. And I don't think it's like they're just targeting only four, but I think what they probably goes into choosing these four is that they have crossovers that can connect them to the most strains. Is there like a branch out
effect? Yeah, I mean, there's a science to it. I mean, whatever is circulating in Asia in the spring, you know, is usually the flu virus that's going to come and affect us in the following fall, so okay. that when they start manufacturing it in March, they have a pretty good idea of what strains are going to be necessary in the vaccine for the following season.
And I think this is going to shoot you in the foot here a little bit with this findings, but I still so I want to see if you can help me on this, is that it says that the flu mist they found was 46% effective, whereas in that same 2015-2016 study, the flu shot, 65% effective.
Right. It's about two-thirds, yeah.
So, and now, if I'm looking at that, and I'm a parent, especially if I'm a parent who's skeptical about vaccination, then to me, I'm like, well, two-thirds, how is that really a thing? But I could easily wrap my mind around the idea that it's like, well, two-thirds is still a lot. That's the majority of people, right?
Especially if you've got a child who has underlying health issues. If you have a sick, sickly child with asthma, cystic fibrosis, anybody who's had heart surgery, anyone that has, you know, failure to thrive or any kind of metabolic thing like thyroid or diabetes, I mean, they get the flu. They get a lot sicker than so 65% protection is better than 0% protection with these kids. So, I mean, in the old days, those were the only kids we targeted to give the flu vaccine to. I probably had a couple thousand patients when I started, had maybe 100 kids that needed to get the flu vaccine based on the guidelines when I started in the 90s. And that was easy. We'd do Columbus Day and we'd knock out every kid who needed. We get the flu vaccine done in one day. Now it takes me 4 months.
Wow. Wow.
Because now the recommendation isn't just high risk kids. It's everyone six months and up. So it's a lot of kids. I think the newer parents that have come through and, you know, it's probably 7-8 years now that they've made that kind of universal everybody 6 months and up recommendation. You know, the kids who have 8-year-olds are used to coming in every year for the flu vaccine. But a lot of people in my practice who have 15 and 16-year-olds who never had their kids grow up in a time where it was recommended the way it is now, they're the ones that usually sneak past us.
Well, and to give you an idea of, you know, what that, even though it seems like two-thirds isn't a lot, right? So another stat it gives in here is that 58.2% of U.S. children between the ages of 6 months and 17 years, so 58.2% of 6-month-olds to 17-year-olds were vaccinated compared to 59% the previous year, okay? So this is, again, in 2015-16, there were 59%. In 16-17 is what I'm saying. They're saying only 58.2%. No, that can't be right. That's right.
That doesn't seem like a big difference.
No.
It's more than half. It shouldn't be that. You know that.
But hold on. Let me say this. Okay. Let me say this is that here's the difference. In that same year that the committee revealed that 99 children died due to the flu during that season, which is up from 92. So that 0.8 difference of vaccination led to 7 kids dying. Is that a fair assumption to make, do you think, doctor?
Again, it depends on who the kids are that were infected.
So there is a lot of variables.
But if you have a kid who's ill, who has an underlying illness, who gets the flu, whether they're vaccinated or not, if they catch the flu, it's going to be much more serious. And I think the point is that with the flu, there are normal, healthy kids without any underlying problems that die every year from the flu. So that's the reason that they recommend, you know, 6 to 18-year-olds get the flu vaccine every year. And it is right around 100 deaths a year. That is much better than what it used to be before we started doing everybody. You know, we used to just concentrate on the sick kids. And now that we're treating more kids, we're treating the reservoir of germs, which is elementary school aged kids. And that's decreasing the circulation of the flu, too. That could have something to do with why it comes later now. I mean, I can't think of the last time I've had to put a kid in the hospital for the flu.
Wow. Well, and just like what you said is the elementary age, because when I read this part of the stat, it was confusing to me, is that it says the flu vaccine was 61% effective among children between 6 months and 8 years old, 42% across all age groups during the 2016-17 season. The oldest age group, those 65 and older, the vaccine was 25% effective. So the way that
that's pretty nasty. They've actually increased the dose now for, I think, 55 and up, that you get a higher dose. And that's new. I think instead of getting a half of an ml, you get a full ml now as an adult. So you get a higher dose vaccine because of that big difference there. They found that if they give a double dose to elderly people, the immune response is a little better.
They say the vaccine prevented nearly 30% of hospitalizations that might have been caused by the flu, which is what you were saying. You can't remember the last time you had to put a kid in the hospital due to the flu. And that rate was higher, 37% among adults 65 or older in particular. Overall, the vaccine reduced outpatient visits by 42% for influenza A and B viruses last season. And the doctor that is they're interviewing for this article notes that the vaccination numbers do not account for modified cases. When someone gets the flu but does not suffer too much. And his quote is, you got the flu, but you weren't hospitalized and you didn't die.
Right. That. Oh, God, I say that. I say that all the time. Why do you get the flu vaccine? So you don't go to the hospital and you don't die.
Yeah.
That's how you got to put it simple. And, you know? And I have posters up in my room with, you know, statistics and stuff, trying to encourage people with vaccination practice. And, you know, like I said, I'll work with parents if they want to do a different schedule. But once they're around other kids in the Gen Pop, kids got to be vaccinated. That has really, you know, listen, if for a business plan, doctors shouldn't vaccinate anyone. Because we treat illness and it increases office visits. So it's counterproductive to our bottom line to be vaccinating kids. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So the fact that we do that means that it's a really important thing. Because if we didn't vaccinate, I'd probably see 40 patients a day instead of 20.
And how? Like, here's the other thing I'm noticing, and because there's a part of the inner voice that lives in my head is sitting there going, you know, we visit this topic every year, and I wonder if people listening are like, oh, they're talking about the flu virus. Or
because
I wonder if you're like,
it lives on, Justin.
That's why.
It's been going on since the middle of the 90s when they started with the MMR and autism. It has been an uphill battle to get kids vaccinated for my entire career. And you know what? I've read the studies. I mean, it's hard. It really, I say in the Comedy Act, it's hard to have an intelligent conversation with a new mom about the safety of vaccines when she just called her kid's belly button the umbilical cord. Okay, so it's they may read stuff, but they don't have the underlying knowledge to be able to process stuff correctly. You know what I mean?
Yes. So in your opinion,
have to be able to critically read studies and be able to understand that, you know, it doesn't just come from reading an article. And I hate to say that, but we did learn a little more, a little extra stuff by going to school that extra 7 years for medical school and residency. Okay. We picked up a few extra things that help us to interpret the data in a more sensible and a more realistic way. I'm sorry. It wasn't just 7 years of sitting in the cafeteria, drinking coffee and talking to other doctors. We actually picked up a few little pointers here and there.
Well, and the other part of it for me is, you couldn't talk about this necessarily enough, like, because the more that we could get up on a pulpit or soapbox, however you want to put it, and get the message out there, the more people end up being helped by this. Yes, yes?
There are kids who have reactions to vaccines. There are kids who have things that occur in the same time frame as when they get vaccines. They may or may not be related to each other. But yes, everybody's every human being is not one size fits all, you know. So there are going to be kids that are going to have reactions and certain, you know, exposures to things, be them, you know, vaccines, cigarettes, whatever the exposure is, their genetics is going to cause them to be either more or less affected by those triggers and their exposure. So there are, I'm not saying that kids are not, there aren't kids who have horrible reactions to vaccines, but the number of kids that have horrible reactions to vaccines, because every single one of them has to be reported to the vaccine reporting system they have. It's called VAERS. So every bad reaction to a vaccine is reported. So it's documented. And more kids are when you crunch the numbers, the statistics show a huge benefit to vaccines, knowing that anybody who takes any medicine, there's going to be a small percentage of people who are going to have side effects. But the overall good, or public health good, individual good, is that they work for 99% of the people. So that 1% of the people, though, with Facebook and the internet, has a voice now. So it's a much louder voice.
Yeah. So, but in your opinion, you think talking about this is a good thing? You don't, whenever this topic comes up for us, you don't sit there and go, oh, fuck.
Oh, no. I think it needs to be reiterated. And listen, I have this conversation multiple times a day.
All year round.
With people who I probably have had the same conversation with when they had their last kid.
Wow. So, well, and it is, because in the mind of a parent, I can tell you, speak from this end, is that, when this comes around every year, it, like you said, you've said even multiple times during this, is that I think we mentioned this before, but it's easy for someone on our end to kind of lose track of that. And that's why we have to get the cards, and you have to send out all the mailers and the emails and the phone calls and all that stuff, because it's not, we actually probably are so numb to it. We're not even seeing the benefits of the vaccine because it's not a big issue to us, because our kids aren't getting sick because they're getting vaccinated. Right. So therefore, by being lazy about it, we can end up making it a bigger problem.
Right. Mm-hmm. See how that is. And we get there are like incentive programs built in with some of the insurance companies in how we get paid now. So if I have 95% of my kids by the age of 4 are vaccinated, with 100% of their vaccines and 95% vaccine rate, I get like a little kickback. The flu vaccine, if 75% of my patients, by the end of April have gotten the flu vaccine, there's an incentive for that. So these are all metrics that are being measured by the insurance companies, by the state and everything. So, they're well aware of what the vaccines are being given. And, Connecticut still has a religious exemption. I don't know what church that is that they go to, but apparently you can go online and somebody will give you a religious exemption for vaccines. And I don't think that you're able to do that in California anymore.
No, not, they passed legislation. Yeah.
You still have that option. So, the kids that are unimmunized or under-immunized by the time they go into the Gen Pop, I usually ask them to find another doctor.
Wow. Because you feel so strongly about it.
Well, I feel strongly about it. And you know what? It's 25 years of practice and 7 years of medical school before that. So 32 years of doing this. And that's what I do. That's what I read about. That's what I go to courses for. This is what I do. Okay. Yeah. So I know it's silly and I may have said it before, but I have a mug that says, please do not mistake your Google search for my medical degree.
Yes. I love it. I love every time you say that. Let's take another break. And then we have a couple more quick hit articles when we come back. If you want to support the show, make sure you go to the dadpodcast.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the page. There's an Amazon banner. Click on that Amazon banner. Bookmark it as your Amazon link. Every time you go back and shop, Jeff Bezos sends yours truly a check. And it's only 5%, 10%, maybe 3%, depending on whatever it is you're getting. But here's the kicker. It doesn't affect you in the slightest. He doesn't take that money from you. All it does is support the show whenever you use Amazon, and we all use Amazon. So it's fantastic, and I really appreciate it. I just want to be part of your family. I've noticed this a lot lately. More and more people. I work around a lot of 20-something-year-olds. In fact, I just finished a run getting trained by a 24-year-old to do a job, which is very interesting when you're in your mid to late 30s and making a career change. Here's the thing. It doesn't bother me. It bothers me none. Not whatsoever. Because they've got the experience. In fact, the first time it happened, they were like, does it weird you out that somebody who's like 22 is telling you how to do your job? I'm like, not at all. They know more than me. I don't have an ego. But my point is, there's lots of tattooing going on, and it's not like sleeves. It's not full blown. I don't see a huge uptick in that, but everybody seems to have some kind of word. And what is very interesting is that now it's not just on a shoulder or on the back, or you got the tramp stamp, or, I mean, I'm not seeing their pelvis, or even their tramp stamp, but it's like on weird, like just on the inside of the biceps, a lot of right on the wrist tattoos, yep, a lot of finger tattoos. And so you found this, this great article that you sent my way, and I know that you see patients that are well into their mid-20s, but what it basically saying is that younger generations, up to 30-40% of people between the ages of 18 and 30 have become kind of piercing or have some kind of piercing or tattoo. And basically, it's much more accepted in the younger generations than its older generation. So because of this tremendous uptick, all of a sudden the AAP is weighing in on this. Am I right?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, when I was in medical school and training, you know, wasn't the purview of the pediatrician. But a lot of this stuff is now gets younger and younger. And I do. I see kids come in at 16, 15 with, you know, their belly button pierced. And, you know, all of those have to be consented by appearance. The parents, I see, you know, lots of tattoos coming in. I'm glad that those ear gauges have faded out a little bit, because I used to have a kid come in. He had such a big hole in his ear. He had a CVS medicine cap in one of his ear gauges. And I'm like, how are you ever going to get a job, buddy? But
you know who's not glad that those are fading out is everybody who had those ear gauges, because there is no way to fix that unless you get like surgery, right?
Plastic surgery is the only way to do it. Yeah, and it's horrible. And the tattoos, again, you know, they're nice when you want to express yourself in your 20s. But, you know, think about your wedding dress. Think about going to a PTA meeting with a sleeveless shirt. You know, these are things that don't go away. And while you feel one way in your, you know, late teens, early 20s, you might feel very differently in your 30s and 40s. One of my nurses, in fact, had a bunch of tattoos she got in her late teens, early 20s, and has spent most of her early 30s having them all lasered off. So, you know, I mean, you could do that later, but yeah, I would say it's an incredible. I have a staff of 14 people in my office, myself, my partner Dr. Stewart, and 12 women that work with me, and I would say that all except two have some kind of tattoo.
Wow. See, that's the thing is that I wonder,
I didn't get mine until I was 48.
Well, and that's the thing. I had the only time I came very, very close to getting a tattoo is we were at the radio show. We had this guy these people who bid to get a tattoo with one of the on-air people. And so we had this tattoo artist who was coming in to do this thing that we would do for charity. And I wanted to just have him give me a dot somewhere, like, so it would look kind of like a mole that would never go away, just so I could know what it feels like to get tatted. Yeah. But I knew my wife would kill me because my wife has wanted a tattoo, and I for some reason I decided to play her father in this role where I was just like, I said no. I said, you're not getting a tattoo, and she was like, you can't tell me that what I can. I said, yes, I can, because I plan to have children with you, and you can't tell your kids they can't have a tattoo when you have a tattoo. Now I have children, and I know I can tell them lots of things that I've done that they can't do. That's my job as a parent. But
right.
My point being is that with this uptick is that, will it just become more and more culturally accepted where you, because now, you know, you go to the Outback Steakhouse and the guy's got what looks like a thermal shirt on underneath, but they just have the sleeves that they're wearing. We went to a pumpkin patch at a local farm recently, and the girl hosting the show had one of those like kind of like nylon sleeves that she put over. And I'm assuming it's just to cover her sleeve of tattoos, because you're not allowed to have tattoos that are exposed when you're working at this farm. And do we eventually just transition out of that to where, you know, oh, nobody cares? I mean, I'm trying to think I wonder if there's anybody listening to this right now who's like, if I see somebody who has an arm of tattoos, like, do I go, oh, you're that kind of person? Are you still perceived a certain way? I don't know.
So what is that term going to be where we're
tattoo inked conscientious?
Yeah, not racist, but Inkist.
Yeah.
We're anti-Inkist.
Yeah. A body artist.
I don't know.
Well, and so let's talk about it real quick. Is that what are the health risks that can come from tattoos and piercings? And let's say I'm a parent who's got a 14-year-old who's like, I really want to get a tat on my shoulder. I'll pay for it. I've worked for it. You know, that kind of stuff. What are the reasons why I shouldn't sign off on this? Or maybe I've got somebody who wants to get a belly button piercing or just an ear piercing or whatever.
You're a mom or a dad, and you have a 14-year-old. And even though they're 14 and want something, it's just like when they want something when they're two, you know better than they do that what they want isn't something they should have at a certain time or an age. And tattoos do have some risk with them. You know, there's always the risk of infection. You go to a reputable tattoo place that's licensed. You're not going to be at risk for catching things like hepatitis and stuff from the needles and everything if you go to a reputable place. But I think doing something permanent like a tattoo before the kid is old enough to really know what that means, that falls under being a parent and just, you know, saying, listen, there's a time for everything. This isn't the time. When you're older, you can make that decision. In terms of piercings, I mean, most of those are not permanent. So, you know, if it's something that, you know, is something, you know, that some child really wants, I mean, we do pierce their ears. Some kids get their ears pierced before they've had their first chance to breastfeed. You know, they get it done in the nursery, for Christ's sake. So, yeah. The piercing, I think, is less of an issue. I pierce ears at my office. I only do lobes, and I only put one hole in each lobe. I don't pierce cartilage. I don't pierce anywhere else on the body. I didn't realize I'd have to, as a pediatrician, have a piercing policy for my staff, but I do.
Is there a piercing that is, like, where would you draw the line? Because it sounds like you'll say just an earlobe, no problem, limited risk there. Is there one that
cartilage in the ear? Kid wants to have a belly button piercing and wants to and knows how to take care of it because that's the other thing too is that, you know, the younger kids don't take care of these things and they get infected. And, you know, I got a pair of bolt cutters in my office that I've had to use to cut infected umbilical piercings, and I'm constantly taking the backings out of earrings that have become embedded in a red, swollen, infected earlobe. I mean, I see that every couple of weeks. So
really? Wow.
You know, the kids got to take care of this stuff once they have it because, you know, the body's gonna react to it.
Is there one that's more dangerous than the other, like, or the most dangerous in the piercing area?
I mean, none of the kids in my practice are having their genitals pierced or anything like that, but I'd imagine that that's an area.
Even above tongue?
Infection. The one of my receptionists who I let go about 2 months ago decided to have her tongue pierced, and she's a receptionist. She has to talk to people on the phone. You could not understand. That wasn't the reason she was fired. She was a nitwit. But you go and pierce your tongue when you're in a pediatric environment and you have to talk to people in person and over the telephone. They got to be able to understand you. Am I wrong?
No, that's
your job.
Yeah.
So. But yes, if I had receptionists with pierced tongues in my 25 years, I've had three.
But is the tongue more dangerous to infection than, say, a belly button, or are they all that pretty much the same?
I couldn't answer that with any certainty.
Okay.
I don't have the stats on that.
So you're mainly what you're saying is a piercing is less of a concern, but you're more concerned
it's
with
not permanent.
Yeah.
It's
the
not
long term. It's not health risk. It's long term life risks and just kind of managing their brain for them.
Right.
Yeah. Speaking of brain, playing tackle football before 12 is tied to brain problems later. So what the gist of this is that they talked to 214 former players with an average age of 51. 43 played high school, 103 played through college, and the remaining 68 played in the NFL. And they found that those who played youth football before the age of 12 had a twofold risk of problems with behavioral regulation, apathy, and executive function. So what does that really mean? Behavior regulation, I would imagine, means emotion. What's apathy and executive function?
Apathy is just you don't care. You know,
wow. So that would lead to almost like a depression state?
Well, you know, just no desire to do anything. You know, it's like, whatever, you know, that kind of
dead inside.
And, And executive function is just cognitive function, the way you think, the way your brain works.
So would it even be like motor skills? Would that fall underneath that? Or is it just like thinking straight?
Under that. No, they didn't. I don't think I heard them say motor skills.
No, it just said executive function. That's what I'm trying to figure out. Okay. And then they had a threefold risk for clinically elevated depression scores. Now, my opinion on this is that I would curious to see is that
maybe it's because they had one of those really competitive fathers who insisted they play football and lived vicariously through their child. Maybe that's the cause of the depression.
And I am not that father, but I think if I let my kid play tackle football next year, is that how much of this do you think can really be changed? Is it just a PR move, this heads up tackling where they're teaching kids to lead with their shoulder and not their head? I mean, I'm sure it's not going to eliminate it, but I would imagine it would greatly decrease the amount of head trauma in these situations, because they were literally taught, we were taught to lead with our head first and have our head up so we didn't injure our neck, but your head was the first thing to go into a tackle.
That's usually right.
So if I'm a dad,
they're going to have to teach it differently if football is going to continue. We love to watch football, but you know, every study shows now, you know, and they look at more and more, deceased football player brains. I mean, it's like 97% of the brains they've looked at of deceased football players have some kind of brain injury from constant impact.
Wow. So if I'm a dad who wants my kid to play tackle football because I see a lot of, you know, benefited, you know, and the kid wants to play, but I know I'm playing stereotypes, and I'm sorry, I'm a wild sexist and chauvinist, but you know, mom is, because I'm kind of really what I'm saying is my own house. My wife is probably going to be like, ooh, I don't know about tackle football, but you could say, well, they're tackling with their shoulder. You know what I mean? And and I've talked to actual Pop Warner coaches now who also coach at the high school level. And he said, we are so sensitive about concussion protocols and stuff now, even at the youth age, that if a kid,
and they
even,
have to be, yes.
Because they don't always have somebody on the sideline beyond an EMT, but they have somebody who is trained in the protocol here in Burbank. And that if a kid gets their bell rung, kids out of the game for the rest of the game. They don't risk it. They don't do anything because they can't. Whatever you see in the NFL,
your quarterback.
Yeah, and what you see in the NFL is even more strict in the high school, right? That's what I'm seeing. So
I would say, Justin, that they wear a lot of padding. There's a lot of protective stuff. Probably to me, and this is, you know, just me talking, not based on anything other than my own thoughts, I think 8 to 12 year olds is probably a better time to play football because there's going to be less. I mean, they don't have as much force to be able to cause injury. They learn the game. They learn the right way to tackle, the right way to fall. If you train them right, I'd be more worried about a 12 to 18 year old playing at, you know, a middle school or high school level where the kids are bigger and stronger and things happen faster and they take harder hits. I mean, I think 8 to 12, getting a kid, letting them get their feet wet in any and all sports that might be of interest to them, that's the time to do it, 8 to 12. And you may not have a, you know, high school or college level football player, but, you know, at least they get the experience to know that, you know, they tried everything out. And then, you know, by 12 to 14 is usually when kids settle into whatever their seam is that they like. They play soccer, they're going to do, you know, soccer, you know, all year. But I think 8 to 12 is the time to get your feet wet and see what it is that you like and what you enjoy. And everything is exercise and discipline, so none of it is harmful, I think. But I do think that, you know, the brains are still growing from, you know, up till the age of 18, the brain isn't mature. So, you know, lots of things can happen. And again, it depends on the play. It depends on the hit. It depends on the circumstances. And bad things are going to happen. And again, those bad things, which are very uncommon, now have a platform to just make it seem like it's a lot worse than it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a solid point. I like that idea because, yeah, anytime you've ever seen a peewee football game, it's more adorable than it is aggressive.
Yes,
more than it's just, not, it's they just not fall violent. Into each other.
Exactly. And that's the same thing. If you watch girls soccer, you know, the ball's there and you have six girls in a circle trying to kick the ball at the same time. And they're just kicking it around in a circle. Or when they're even younger, you know, they just, oh, no, you take it. That's fine. They're very, you know, nice out there. And then you see them do it in high school and they're vicious. And it's a whole different level.
It gets
play.
Like a high school cat fight. It gets intense, man.
Yeah.
Girl fights were always more big.
I've never seen a high school field hockey game. Oh, my God. I mean, they're violent.
It's a bloodbath, man.
I know. I don't even want to be near the field with my head injury.
That's so funny.
But I think that and the other thing too is you have to gear kids' sports at 8 to 12 to be recreational and non-competitive. I mean, keep score because I think it's important. Otherwise, what's the point? But you want to make it so that they have the opportunity to learn the sport before they're competing in the sport. And that's what 8 to 12 should be. I find it amazing that such young kids have competitive travel soccer with, 8, 9, and 10-year-olds who don't even know soccer yet. They know how to run and kick. That's, it's crazy. But you want kids to you want everyone to get a chance to figure out what floats their boat. And, a lot of the rec departments in our area, in the summer, they'll have a camp where you'll play soccer, basketball, football, baseball over a 4-week period. And, you get exposed to all, four sports. And I think that kind of stuff is good.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. Well put, Doc. That's our show. You could send, if you have a question for Dr. J, you'd like to shoot him next time, send us an email to show@thedadpodcast.com. You can also follow him on Twitter and chat with him there. It's at Dr. J Sute. That is in the description of this episode. If you want to see if he's doing comedy in an area near you, head trauma and all, standuppediatrician.com. You can also pick up his album there, 50 Shades of J. Am I right? Is that?
Yeah, don't even worry about that anymore. Okay. I'm so much funnier now.
Good. Trust me. I know that feeling. They play my my first album the most on satellite radio. And I'm like, Balls, you guys are ruining my career.
Yeah, I know.
Why did I say that to you?
I recorded one DVD like 7 years ago when I'm still wearing the white coat. Yeah. I'm like, holy shit, was I in trouble.
That's good stuff.
We're going to table children ashamed of their tips. See parents until the next time. Little teaser for the next podcast.
Yes. If what happens if you get tipsy or drunk in front of your kids a lot, and then we're also going to be talking all things poop. The shit show. If you're excited for an analyzing your kid's shit, which by the way, I learned, and we'll talk about it next week. Next time is that I learned that my son might be constipated, not just taking forever on the toilet and is lost in his thoughts, but I didn't know that, and I learned it from somebody explaining me how to look at his poop and see what's going on with it. So
Bristol stool chart.
I hate that it's named after Bristol Farms. Which I don't know if that's a thing out there, but it's a thing here. Anyway, all right. On behalf of Dr. J, this is Just Worship saying hug your kids, hump your loved one, and stay frosty, my friends.